The whole of science is nothing more than the refinement of everyday thinking, a quote attributed to Albert Einstein, a 20th century physicist. Hello and welcome to the Western Traditions Podcast. This is episode 25 of The Greek Sun, a series of podcasts about ancient Greece. So far in the chronology which I have followed, the podcast has stopped midway during the Peloponnesian War, during the Peace of Nicias. At this point, in light of the carnage and pestilence and destruction that has characterized the war, I thought it would be timely to introduce the sequence of episodes about Greek science, beginning with the work of Hippocrates, a Greek physician of the 5th century BC. But before we begin, allow me to direct you to the website, western-traditions.org, that's western-traditions.org, where you can find all the episodes of this podcast. There as well, you can find some helpful maps and pictures, check out my source lists, and find some good books to read to support your own learning. And while you're there, check out the shopping page for some Western Traditions merchandise or contribute directly to the support of the podcast through the PayPal or Patreon options. Now, you can find my podcast in a number of places besides my website. I'm on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Podbean, YouTube, and other platforms. Wherever you listen, please remember to like, share, subscribe, and leave a comment where you can. And now, let's take a look at the origins and progress of science, and particularly medicine, during the classical age of ancient Greece. There is a propensity among people today to think of science as something recent in the grand scheme of things anyway. They think that science is a recent invention, that it began after the Middle Ages, maybe. These same people will often say things like, well, now we have technology, whereas in the past, according to their thinking, we didn't have technology. And if pressed to be specific, they might say technology started with the first computers in the mid-20th century, or with rockets, or with cars a few decades earlier than that. They think that technology is inseparable from electricity and machines. In reality, science is a word that simply means knowledge, a body of knowledge related to a specific field of activity or thought. And we have had science since the very beginning of the human race. As I quoted Einstein at the beginning of the episode, science is just the refinement of our thinking. The first hominids, splitting and flaking stones to make scrapers and to make spear points and to make axe heads, these men and women possessed and practiced a science. The first people to make wagon wheels and wagon axles possessed and applied a science, a body of knowledge about these mechanisms. They were able to do something and to understand basic physics in a way that virtually none of us can now, even though we may profess a faith in technology, when really all we mean is that we just know how to use a computer keyboard with a certain amount of proficiency. We are actually much less capable of survival, and we are less capable of producing technology with our own hands than any of our quote-unquote primitive ancestors. And all these things that they were able to do, that our ancestors were able to make, these things were technology. Technology simply means tools. And the first time that we picked up a stick to ward off an enemy, to stoke a fire, or even just to scratch our back, we were using technology. There's actually a great British TV series from the 1970s called Connections with James Burke, and one of the episodes demonstrates that you can essentially draw a straight line from the plow, which would have been invented as far back as 10,000 years ago. He draws a straight line from plow technology to B-52 bombers, which in the 1970s were top-of-the-line tech. Because all technology is related, and all technology really goes back to the first time our ancestors picked up a stick or a rock and used it as an extension of their own power and skill, as a missile, as a club, or as a digging or a scraping tool. We were adapting the world around us to our own needs and desires. So the people who built Göbekli Tepe over 10,000 years ago, they had technology. And so also the ancient Babylonians had technology. That is how they raised the ziggurats and how they channeled the waters of their rivers. The Egyptians also possessed science, and not the alien-assisted kind popularly espoused by internet conspiracy cranks. They possessed the required knowledge, the science, the geometry, the tools to build the pyramids. And nearly as old as all human applied sciences, those that involved making and building, that is nearly as old, possibly maybe older, is the human science of astronomy. With regard to the skies, the ancients were not just surprisingly informed, they actually possessed knowledge beyond that of our own, in the sense that the regular man in the street, so to speak, back then, this average man, could tell you more about the night sky and the movements of the celestial bodies there than the average man of today's technologically advanced society. Yes, yes, I know, in school we learn scientifically advanced ideas about the movements of the celestial bodies, the stars and the planets, their position, their size. We learn about their composition, but we do so in an air-conditioned classroom, and we never look up. The ancients did not study the skies in a book. They lived beneath those skies. They were intimately familiar with the movement of the moon and the planets through that starry background, and they made surprisingly accurate calculations about their movements. Already in the Greek history that we have learned coming up to the Peloponnesian War, we have heard about how the philosopher Thales predicted solar eclipses. But even before him, the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians had been using astronomy to make their calendars. And we all know that they used shockingly precise geometry in their great public constructions, such as in the ziggurats and the pyramids. And with the pre-Socratic philosophers that I discussed just a few episodes ago, we have really begun to study Greek efforts in science, as they began with the investigation into the basic materials of being, the substances which compose all things, from rocks to humans to the sun, and they had answers that included everything from one of the four elements, that is, earth, wind, fire, or water, to a strikingly accurate declaration that all things were made from tiny, indivisible particles called atoms. But by the time of the Peloponnesian War, and certainly before that, the Greeks had also begun to compile and use knowledge about the biological sciences, especially the science of medicine. The science of medicine, like many sciences, has its origins in mythology. By the 5th century BC in Greece, there were already a number of temples dedicated to Asclepius, a legendary healer who, according to the myths, was a son of the god Apollo. In these temples, the healing was mostly done, or hoped to be done, through prayer and sacrifice, at least initially. The ailing were brought to the temple to make propitiation to the pertinent gods, and then to sleep in the temple, and to have their dreams interpreted in the morning. Apparently, certain non-venomous snakes slithered freely around the floors of these temples. And yes, this presence of snakes, whatever it meant, leads us to the famous rod of Asclepius, a staff with a serpent entwined around it, used sometimes even as a modern medical symbol. Although you may have seen more often something called the caduceus, a winged staff with two snakes wrapped around it. That's actually a symbol of the god Hermes, but that's another topic. The significance of snakes and gods in these symbols is a great research subject, especially if you are using this podcast in the homeschool context, but for the moment, we're going to leave it behind. At some point, anyway, and perhaps many centuries before the time period of which I speak, the era of the Peloponnesian War, the physicians associated with the temples of healing went beyond prayer and began to apply techniques and to develop theories about medicine and health. Doubtless, much of this knowledge of medicine goes far back into the deep past of humanity, passed down through the centuries by shamans and midwives and such, who also mixed prayer with applied practices such as the making of poultices and potions. We still make a lot of these same poultices and potions today, but we call them wound dressings and pharmaceuticals, and big corporations sell them to you for outrageous profits. But that is a tirade that I will follow up on in another episode in another series. But anyway, sometime during the 5th century BC, a certain Asclepiad, that is, a follower of Asclepius, had gained a following of his own in Greece. And he, or his followers, has left to us a corpus of writings now included among the greatest books of the Western world. His name was Hippocrates. we do not know very much about Hippocrates. Most of what we do profess to know about the man, we get through the dialogues of Plato. From those texts, we learn that Hippocrates was born on the island of Kos, which lies off the coast of western Anatolia. Now, Kos was a Doric colony, related, in other words, by dialect and possibly by culture, to the Peloponnesus and to Sparta. To some extent, this seems appropriate. The text of Hippocrates' corpus of works is certainly written in a precise and laconic style, for the most part, just as the Spartan character was famously described. However, all of Hippocrates' writings come down to us in Ionic Greek, the dialect of Athens, and in his writings and his rare digressions, he definitely seems to demonstrate political leanings more typically associated with Athens. For instance, in the text known as On Airs, Water, and Places, in which Hippocrates describes the impact of climate and the environment on human health, he digresses from a discussion on reproduction to relate how men in Asia are naturally cowards since they are enslaved to kings and accustomed to submission, and he suggests that it is only in democratic cultures, like that of Athens, remember, it's only those democratic cultures which produce vigorous men. Now, we also know that Hippocrates was an Asclepiad, a member of that medical guild which claimed descent from Asclepius. Beyond this, there is very little that we do know of the man that is not essentially legendary, that he traveled from town to town and was renowned for his knowledge of the body, its ills, and its cures, and that ultimately he came to Athens to work and to pass down his body of knowledge. Now, outside of Plato, there is another account of the life of Hippocrates, much more detailed, that comes out of ancient Alexandria in Egypt. It tells of his descent from Heracles and from Asclepius, of his youth, of his studies in medicine and philosophy, and of various miraculous medical cures he is said to have worked. Also, according to the legend, he refused to travel to Persia when his presence was requested to heal the great king. He was apparently such a patriot that he could not, in good conscience, aid the ancestral enemy of all Greeks, and he let the king die. The dates given for his death range greatly. Some are as late as 350 BC, which actually places the life of Hippocrates really after the Peloponnesian War and after the appearance of Plato and Socrates. But regardless of when he lived, how he lived, or exactly when he died, there appeared at this time schools dedicated to his teachings. We possess today a body of writings in his name, which may have been compiled by his disciples of a later age. But whoever composed them, they are the earliest Western writings on the science of medicine in existence. The volume of Hippocrates' writings is typically prefaced with the famous Hippocratic Oath. You may have heard of it as some sort of binding oath which medical doctors take upon graduation or upon passing their licensing exams. In fact, some medical schools do still use a version of the oath today, but it has been modified to adjust it to modern sensibilities and morality. The original oath prohibited doctors from performing abortions, for instance, and that oath obviously would not be administered today. But it still echoes many of the restrictions that medical ethics applies today, such as not intentionally trying to cause harm to a patient, and it forbids doctors from speaking of a patient's private information with others. Here is a translation of the original complete oath. I swear by Apollo the physician, and Asclepius, and all the gods and goddesses, that according to my ability and judgment, I will keep this oath and this stipulation, to reckon him who taught me this art equally dear to me as my parents, to share my substance with him and relieve his necessities if required, to look upon his offspring on the same footing as my own brothers, and to teach them this art, if they shall wish to learn it, without fee or stipulation, and that by precept, lecture, and every other mode of instruction, I will impart a knowledge of the art to my own sons and those of my teachers, and to disciples bound by a stipulation and oath according to the laws of medicine, but to none others. I will follow that system of regimen which, according to my ability and judgment, I consider for the benefit of my patients, and abstain from whatever is deleterious and mischievous. I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor suggest any such counsel. And in like manner, I will not give to a woman a medicine to produce abortion. With purity and with holiness, I will pass my life and practice my art. I will not cut persons laboring under the stone, but will leave this to be done by men who are practitioners of this work. Into whatever houses I enter, I will go into them for the benefit of the sick, and I will abstain from every voluntary act of mischief and corruption, and further, from the seduction of females or males, of freemen or slaves. Whatever in connection with my professional practice or not, in connection with it, I see or hear in the life of men, which ought not to be spoken of abroad, I will not divulge, reckoning that all such should be kept secret. Will I continue to keep this oath unviolated? May it be granted to me to enjoy life and the practice of the art, respected by all men in all times. But should I trespass and violate this oath, may the reverse be my lot. Hippocrates frequently emphasizes diet as an ingredient in treatment. Of course, you have to remember that prior to the last century or so, there were not many quote-unquote drugs available. Today, a person in the West cannot watch anything on TV or elsewhere without seeing an advertisement for one or another drug, drugs to soothe psoriasis symptoms, to prevent hair loss, to remediate menstrual cramps, to enable or improve male romantic performance, to control mood, to manage diabetes, and so on. Not long ago, there were mostly only roots, herbs, and dietary applications that doctors could rely on to ease the health complaints of their patients. Now, this may be a topic for my 9th series on contemporary issues, but many might say that modern medicine, for all its advancements in human health, has nevertheless lost something in its dependence on synthesized drugs and in its move away from the natural products of the earth. Anyway, for Hippocrates and the physicians of his time, when he says the word drugs, he is typically referring to some concoction that we would probably identify as an herbal remedy or even a potion of some kind. More often than not, the drug is something like tisane, that's P-T-I-S-A-N, tisane, that's a tea made from barley, or Hippocrates will speak of using a mixture made from honey or vinegar or some combination of such ingredients. In other passages, Hippocrates recommends drinking something called kikion. I'm doing my best with the spelling and the pronunciation there. This is something that I alluded to in an earlier episode with regard to Greek religion in the classical era. Kikion is, in some context anyway, thought to have indicated a beverage made from barley that had some hallucinatory side effects. I will get into that in another episode and its relation to Greek religious practices, but I thought it interesting that the term appears here alongside tisane, and it's therefore obviously indicating a separate drink, since it's mentioned along with it, rather than it simply appearing as a synonym for tisane. Now, even today, though, much of the medicine that we use to treat everyday complaints, such as headache, diarrhea, constipation, fevers, upset stomachs, even today, most of the medical solutions either openly or discreetly rely on natural substances. For example, aspirin is made from the bark of the willow tree, and we use it today even to treat and or prevent heart attacks and to treat pain and fever. Digoxin, a drug commonly used to treat arrhythmias of the heart, digoxin is derived from a flowering plant called foxglove. The list of modern medicines derived from plants and ancient remedies goes on. As a further example, in the times of our great-grandmothers and their ancestors, honey was used in poultices to help heal wounds. While modern medicine scoffed at these solutions for some time, now the pharmaceutical industry sells wound dressings laced with honey, for exorbitant prices, of course. Maybe we should have listened to our grandmothers. They did the same work without bankrupting us. But anyway, Hippocrates also prescribes fasting as a form of treatment, and thus he uses both nourishment and its lack as a medicine. And it's not just specific foods and herbs that Hippocrates uses to treat his patients, but he also makes general dietary recommendations. In his essay on ancient medicine, Hippocrates observes that nobody would have sought medicine at all if the same kind of diet suited men both in sickness and in health. Interestingly, in his writing on acute diseases, Hippocrates makes reference again to dietary regimen for two different kinds of people. For those who eat twice a day, and those who eat only once a day. He does not mention three times a day. Now, I do not do a podcast on diet, but I think this is a very interesting reference, given the modern assumption that three meals a day are normal. And now even some people say that you should be eating even more often, throwing in snacks or eating six times a day, and all this in the face of the worst obesity and diabetes crisis in the history of the human race. And yet here we have ancient testimony to dietary schedules that involve eating much less frequently. In fact, there is an ancient Egyptian saying about this matter, and I think that Hippocrates would have agreed. It goes something like this: one quarter of our food keeps us alive, the rest of our food keeps doctors alive. The meaning, if not clear already, is that only a little of what we eat is really necessary. The rest causes all the health complications that doctors make money off of when we get ill from all the Doritos and the ice cream and the pizza and the alcohol. Now, my apologies if you're a fan of those gastronomic nightmares, but the truth is that the ancients understood that the human body actually needs very little nutrition to sustain itself, and that going much beyond these limits ends up making you ill. And they're not wrong. Hippocrates himself notes the misfortune that so many people eat what they know will hurt them, they eat in quantities beyond the necessary, and that they drink too much alcohol. Given the paucity of his resources, Hippocrates also recommends wine as a medicine in particular cases. In one passage, he recommends pouring it into or over a wound. And when you remember that wine has a high alcohol content, this kind of makes sense as a disinfectant procedure. Although, I'm not sure that the high sugar content of wine would be good for the wound, given that bacteria's love for sugar, but then again, I'm just a nurse, and I'll let the PhDs answer that one. The number of illnesses and symptoms presented in the work of Hippocrates is staggering. He addresses the identification and treatment of things like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, fevers, abdominal pain, kidney stones, complications associated with childbirth, jaundice, bone fractures, hemorrhoids, even epilepsy. His description of how to treat hemorrhoids, in fact, is still quite relevant today, in that modern surgeons still use his approaches of cautery, strangulation, or excision. Of course, looked at from another point of view, instead of a compliment to Hippocrates, this might be an insult to modern physicians since they're still using techniques from over 2,000 years ago. And besides food, Hippocrates also recognizes the importance of environment on health. And by this term, I refer also to seasons, to weather, to heat, cold, moisture, dryness, and so on. He states that, for instance, that the best water for health comes from on high, such as rainwater, but also any water running fast down a steep mountainside is preferable to standing water. Now, this may appear obvious to us now, but again, it is interesting to see the ancients recognizing this without being able to put their finger on just why it is. Today, we would recognize that it's harder for harmful bacteria to accumulate in running water or rainwater, and that sitting water is an obvious no-no due to this. But my point here and elsewhere is that the ancients were really already aware of many of the same dangers to our health and their manifestations that we are aware of today, but they achieved this knowledge without the aid of a microscope. However, Hippocrates and others, they were usually unable to explain why many illnesses fell upon us, or the explanations that they did have been proven to be an error now that we have microscopes and thanks to the development of germ theory in the 19th century. The ancients, like Hippocrates, were stuck with recognizing symptoms without being able to detect causes. He sees jaundice, for example, as an illness itself, rather than what it actually is. It's typically a symptom of some sort of liver failure caused by hepatitis, cancer, or some other cause associated with liver function. But even today, we moderns still treat symptoms rather than causes, just like the ancients did. Consider fevers. A lot of people think that when they're sick, if they treat the fever, then they're getting better. They take some aspirin or a Tylenol, for instance, and they feel better and they think they've knocked down whatever virus is attacking their body. We're happy with our results, just like the ancients would have been. However, modern science actually teaches us that fever is our body's weapon against the microbes that are a danger to us. The fever is actually your friend and ally in the war on bacteria and viruses. It makes you feel bad, yeah, but it's killing the bad guys in your bloodstream because they thrive on 37 degrees Celsius that environment in your blood. And when you heat up with fever, they can't survive. Now, fortunately, even when we eliminate the fever, our body has multiple layers of defenses and other counter strategies to fight infection, and you can relax. You're probably just fine taking that Tylenol and getting a break from your fever, though your liver might not agree, but that's another episode entirely. But you can see in this, hopefully, how we modern advanced humans are still stuck on appearances when it comes to health. Now, Hippocrates also, he tries to group symptoms in different ways to identify different illnesses, but in truth, he and his colleagues were truly battling a panoply of diseases and ailments that included everything from measles and mumps to typhus and tetanus, and he was taking them on mostly with just barley tea, fasting, and measures of rest. Instead of laughing at his backwardness, though, we should probably admire the audacious bravery of these ancient physicians. They were, like the Spartans, essentially making a stand at Thermopylae every day that they went to work. They were outnumbered and outarmed, and yet boldly they held the gates against infection, accident, and disease. Now, in his writings, Hippocrates also brings up the subject of the four humors. The word humor is derived from the original Greek word chymos, and the four humors refers to the four substances or fluids with which the ancients believed the body was filled. The actual number of humors differed from one practitioner and theorist to the next, but history generally settles on four as the quantity. These four humors are usually remembered as blood, phlegm, black bile, and yellow bile. You can probably see that the ancients made this determination based on what they saw coming out of the body, excluding urine and feces, which were obviously waste matter. The four humors, or fluids then, according to this thesis, were naturally present in the human body and had to be maintained in a certain balance in order to preserve human health. Illness was a result, or was at least corollary to, the imbalance of these substances. Too much or too little blood, too much or too little bile, and so on. And while we may scoff at this theory, we should recognize that there's something substantially correct about it. The health of the human body is very dependent on fluid balances, and closely related to this, electrolyte imbalance due to diabetes, dehydration, organ failure, and other reasons. Electrolyte imbalance is one of the major reasons for admittance to the emergency room. So the ancients were right in determining that the importance of this internal balance, even if their knowledge of the exact fluids was inaccurate. We will return to this topic of humors again when we study the medical treatises of Galen in the Roman series, and again in the series on the Middle Ages, and again after that, because you see, the theory of the four humors would continue to influence not only medicine but philosophy down through the ages. Really, medical ideas relied on this theory of the humors all the way until germ theory was accepted, less than 200 years ago. Hippocrates also gets into the nitty-gritty of surgery and the hands-on work of medical science, describing how and when to make incisions, for example. For the actual surgery, he lays out how the surgeon should be assisted, where instruments should be placed, and how he should care for his hands. He even mentions that the fingernails should be kept trimmed. He describes in great detail how to reduce, that is, realign and splint, fractured bones and dislocated joints. He describes proper methods of cautery and demonstrates a remarkable knowledge of anatomy. In one passage, he describes the veins and the arteries running out of and into the heart, naming the vena cava and the hepatic vein, among others. Hippocrates is also famous for providing in his text numerous case histories, which continue to provide a framework for doctors and medical students to study patients and their illnesses and the remedies. In a work titled Of the Epidemics, he relates how a town called Thasus was affected by an epidemic. Now, not being a doctor, but more of a pseudo-historian, what I found most entrancing about his writing here is the way that he begins each passage with remarks that seem almost poetical, but really they just simply reflect the kind of astronomical awareness that each person back then had when making reference to time. Here's an example of one passage's beginning. In Thasus, a little before and during the season of Arcturus, there were frequent and great rains with northerly winds about the equinox, and until the setting of the Pleiades, there were a few southerly rains. The winter was northerly and parched, cold and with great winds and snow. Great storms were about the equinox, the spring northerly, dryness, the rains were few and cold. About the summer solstice, scanty rains and great cold, until near the season of the dog star. I mentioned in the opening of this episode that the ancients possessed an awareness of the stars and the planets unparalleled by any modern people alive today. And you can see it here, that even while trying to describe the advent of an epidemic, he naturally makes references to the seasons, the solstices and the equinoxes, and the rising and the setting of different stars, such as the Pleiades and Arcturus and Sirius, the dog star. References which are probably mystifying to most listeners today, even if we recognize the names of stars and the concept of solstices and equinoxes, these are not things that we can easily reference with regard to our personal histories. For example, when you remember, say, your grandfather dying, or your high school graduation, or your first date, you probably remember a month and a day at best. Hippocrates, on the other hand, would have remembered that his grandfather died just before the Pleiades set, or that his graduation was a few weeks before the summer solstice and the winds were southerly. Now, maybe it does not impress you that people possess this kind of awareness. Maybe you are right in thinking that we now possess a more precise and useful form of time reckoning, but hopefully you also agree that something beautiful was lost in the transition to the modern age. Now, before you dismiss Hippocrates as just some antique sawbones that waxed poetic about the rain and the stars every once in a while, though, you might open his essay titled The Sacred Disease. The sacred disease was the name that many ancient people gave to what we would usually call epilepsy. Now, they actually applied this name to anyone having seizures, and there's more than one reason to have seizures besides epilepsy, and these reasons include fever, electrolyte imbalance, and stroke. But generally, we tend to say that sacred disease is usually an ancient reference to epilepsy, the idea being that the seizures were a madness sent by the gods. Julius Caesar, famously, is said to have suffered from epilepsy, though there is, in the modern age, some dispute about that, and they speculate that he was really suffering from many strokes later in his life. But moving on from that, we have discussed Hippocrates' knowledge of skin, organs, and bones so far, but I've left the brain for last. In his treatise on the sacred disease, which he opens by stating that he finds it to be no more sacred than any other disease, Hippocrates demystifies the brain, as well as seizures and epilepsy. Fascinatingly, early in the text, he declares that epilepsy is hereditary, which is in part true, though there are some other factors. Still, as I have said before, the portion of truth that the ancients were able to discover with absolutely no instrumentation and no medical technology of any kind is startling. He accurately describes the brain as being double, having two halves, that is, separated one from the other by a thin membrane. He also correctly recognizes that the brain, like other organs, is complete, essentially, at birth, in terms of its structure anyway, even though we know now that further internal development occurs throughout youth. Astonishingly, though, Hippocrates has this to say about the brain, and I quote, "Men ought to know that from nothing else but the brain comes joys, delights, laughter, and jokes, sorrows, griefs, and lamentations, and by this same organ we become mad and delirious, and fears and terror assail us." Thus, Hippocrates distinguishes his learning from many others in ancient times who might have found the origin of emotions in, say, the heart, and the causes of madness and fear were demons or gods, according to them. No, Hippocrates recognized that it was this organ, the brain, which contained all that made us what we are. As he says later in the essay, it is the brain which interprets and understands. For all that astounds us in Hippocrates, there are still passages which disappoint or underwhelm us. He recommends, for instance, bleeding as a remedy in some places, and we know now that this is generally not a good practice, since we need the blood supply to accomplish all the healing that we require during illness and after injury. And he often relies on picayune sayings that amount to nothing more than moderation is good and excess is bad. But nevertheless, just as much of Greek philosophy asks questions that we still ponder today, there is much in Greek science, and particularly in Greek medicine, that we still apply or base our remedies on today. In future Greek science episodes, we will move on to other biological sciences and take a look at the heavens through Greek eyes. Until then, I thank you for listening to the Western Traditions Podcast.